The Stand by Stephen King. Author's note. This is a work of fiction. Many of the events occur in real places, and with these places I have taken the liberty of changing them to whatever degree best suited the course of my story. This is a monstrous impertinence, and that is as good a definition of the word novel as any. Special thanks are due to Russell Dorr, PA, and Dr. Richard Herman, both of the Bridgeton Family Medical Center, who answered my questions about the nature of the flu and its peculiar way of mutating every 2 years or so, and to Susan Arts Manning of Castine, who proofed the original manuscript. Most thanks of all to Bill Thompson and Betty Prashker, who made this book happen in the best way. Stephen King. Dedication. For my wife, Tabitha, this dark chest of wonders. Outside, the street's on fire, in a real death waltz, between what's flesh and what's fantasy, and the poets down here don't write nothing at all, they just stand back and let it all be, and in the quick of the night, they reach for their moment and try to make an honest stand. Bruce Springsteen. And it was clear she couldn't go on. The door was opened and the wind appeared. The candles blew and then disappeared. The curtains flew and then he appeared. Said, "Don't be afraid. Come on, Mary." And she had no fear, and she ran to him, and they started to fly. She had taken his hand. "Come on, Mary. Don't fear the Reaper." Blue Oyster Cult. Well, the deputy walks on hard nails and the preacher rides a mount, but nothing really matters much. It's doom alone that counts. And the one-eyed undertaker, he blows a futile horn. "Come in," she said. "I'll give you shelter from the storm." Bob Dylan. Book 1. Captain Trips. June 16th to July 4th, 1980. I called the doctor on the telephone, said, "Doctor, doctor, please. I got this feeling, rocking and reeling. Tell me, what can it be? Is it some new disease?" The Silvers. "Baby, can you dig your man? He's a righteous man. Baby, can you dig your man?" Larry Underwood. Chapter 1. Hapscom's Texaco sat on U.S. 93 just north of Arnett, a pissant four-street burg about 110 miles from Houston. Tonight the regulars were there, sitting by the cash register, drinking beer, talking idly, watching the bugs fly into the big lighted sign. It was Bill Hapscom's station, so the others deferred to him even though he was a pure fool. They would have expected the same deferral if they had been gathered together in one of their business establishments, except they had none. In Arnett, it was hard times. In 1970, the town had had two industries, a factory that made paper products, for picnics and barbecues mostly, and a plant that made electronic calculators. Now the paper factory was shut down, and the calculator plant was ailing. They could make them a lot cheaper in Taiwan, it turned out, just like those little portable TVs and transistor radios. Norman Brouette and Tommy Wanamaker, who had both worked in the paper factory, were on relief, having run out of unemployment some time ago. Henry Carmichael and Stu Redman both worked at the calculator plant, but rarely got more than 30 hours a week. Victor Palfrey was retired and smoked stinking home-rolled cigarettes, which were all he could afford. "Now what I say is this," Hap told them, putting his hands on his knees and leaning forward. "They just gotta say screw this inflation shit, screw this national debt shit. We got the presses and we got the paper. We're going to run off $50,000,000 bills and hump them right the Christ into circulation." Palfrey, who had been a machinist until 1974, was the only one present with sufficient self-respect to point out Hap's most obvious damn fool statements. Now, rolling another of his shitty-smelling cigarettes, he said, "That wouldn't get us nowhere. If they do that, it'll be just like Richmond in the last 2 years of the States War. In those days, when you wanted a piece of gingerbread, you gave the baker a Confederate dollar, he'd put it on the gingerbread and cut out a piece just that size. Money's just paper, you know." "I know some people that don't agree with you," Hap said sourly. He picked up a greasy red plastic paper holder from his desk. I owe these people, and they're starting to get pretty itchy about it. Stu Redmond, who was perhaps the quietest man in Arnett, was sitting in one of the cracked plastic Woolco chairs, a can of Pabst in his hand, looking out the big service station window at 93. Stu knew about poor. He had grown up that way right here in town, the son of a dentist who had died when Stu was 7, leaving his wife and 2 other children besides Stu. His mother had gotten work at the Red Ball truck stop just outside of Arnett. Stu could have seen it from where he sat right now if it hadn't burned down in 1969. It had been enough to keep the 4 of them eating, but that was all. At the age of 9, Stu had gone to work, first for Rog Tucker, who owned the Red Ball, helping to unload trucks after school for 35 cents an hour, and then at the stockyards in the neighboring town of Braintree, lying about his age to get 20 backbreaking hours of labor a week at the minimum wage. Now, listening to Hap and Vic Palfrey argue on about money and the mysterious way it had of drying up, he thought about the way his hands had bled at first from pulling the endless hand trucks of hides and guts. He had tried to keep that from his mother, but she had seen, less than a week after he started. She wept over them a little, and she hadn't been a woman who wept easily. But she hadn't asked him to quit the job. She knew what the situation was. She was a realist. Some of the silence in him came from the fact that he had never had friends or the time for them. There was school, and there was work. His youngest brother, Dev, had died of pneumonia the year he began at the yards, and Stu had never quite gotten over that. Guilt, he supposed. He had loved Dev the best. But his passing had also meant there was one less mouth to feed. In high school, he had found football, and that was something his mother had encouraged, even though it cut into his work hours. "You play," she said. "If you got a ticket out of here, it's football, Stuart. You play. Remember Eddie Warfield." Eddie Warfield was a local hero. He had come from a family even poorer than Stu's own, had covered himself with glory as quarterback of the regional high school team, had gone on to Texas A&M with an athletic scholarship, and had played for 10 years with the Green Bay Packers, mostly as a second-string quarterback, but on several memorable occasions as the starter. Eddie now owned a string of fast food restaurants across the West and Southwest, and in Arnett he was an enduring figure of myth. In Arnett, when you said success, you meant Eddie Warfield. Stu was no quarterback, and he was no Eddie Warfield. But it did seem to him as he began his junior year in high school that there was at least a fighting chance for him to get a small athletic scholarship. And then there were work-study programs, and the school's guidance counselor had told him about the NDEA loan program. Then his mother had gotten sick, had become unable to work. It was cancer. 2 months before he graduated from high school, she had died, leaving Stu and his brother Bryce to support. Stu had turned down the athletic scholarship and had gone to work in the calculator factory. And finally it was Bryce, 3 years Stu's junior, who had made out. He was now in Minnesota, a systems analyst for IBM. He didn't write often, and the last time he had seen Bryce was at the funeral, after Stu's wife had died. Died of exactly the same sort of cancer that had killed his mother. He thought that Bryce might have his own guilt to carry, and that Bryce might be a little ashamed of the fact that his brother had turned into just another good old boy in a dying Texas town, spending his days doing time in the calculator plant, and his nights either down at Hap's or over at the Indian Head drinking Lone Star beer. The marriage had been the best time, and it had only lasted 18 months. The womb of his young wife had borne a single dark and malignant child. That had been 3 years ago. Since, he had thought of leaving Arnett, searching for something better. But small-town inertia held him, the low siren song of familiar places and familiar faces. He was well-liked in Arnett, and Vic Palfrey had once paid him the ultimate compliment of calling him old-time tough. As Vic and Hap chewed it out, there was still a little dusk left in the sky, but the land was in shadow. Cars didn't go by on 93 much now, which was one reason Hap had so many unpaid bills. But there was a car coming now, Stu saw. It was still a quarter of a mile distant, the day's last light putting a dusty shine on what little chrome was left to it. Stu's eyes were sharp, and he made it as a very old Chevrolet, 59 or 60. A Chevy, no lights on, doing no more than 15 miles an hour, weaving all over the road. No one had seen it yet but him. Now, let's say you got a mortgage payment on this station, Vic Palfrey was saying. And let's say it's $50 a month. It's a hell of a lot more than that. Well, for the sake of argument, let's say 50. And let's say the Federals went ahead and printed you a whole carload of money. Well, then those bank people would turn around and want 150. You'd just be as poorly off. That's right, Henry Carmichael nodded. Hap looked at him, irritated. He happened to know that Hank had gotten in the habit of taking cokes out of the machine without paying the deposit. And furthermore, Hank knew he knew, and if Hank wanted to come in on any side, it ought to be his. That ain't necessarily how it would be, Hap said weightily from the depths of his ninth grade education. He went on to explain why. Stu, who only understood that they were all in a hell of a pinch, turned Hap's voice down to a meaningless drone and watched the Chevy pitch and yaw its way on up the road. The way it was going, Stu didn't think it was going to make it much further. It crossed the white line and its left-hand tires spumed up dust from the left shoulder. Now it lurched back, held its own lane briefly, then nearly pitched off into the ditch. Then, as if the driver had picked out the big, lighted Texaco station sign as a beacon, it arrowed toward the tarmac like a projectile whose velocity is very nearly spent. Stu could hear the worn-out thump of its engine now, the steady gurgle and wheeze of a dying carb and a loose set of valves. It missed the lower entrance and bumped up over the curb. The fluorescent bars over the pumps were reflecting off the Chevy's dirt-streaked windshield, so it was hard to see what was inside. But Stu saw the vague shape of the driver roll loosely with the bump. The car showed no sign of slowing from its relentless 15. So I say, with more money in circulation, you'd be... Better turn off your pumps, Hap, Stu said mildly. The pumps? What? Norm Brouette had turned to look out the window. Christ on a pony, he said. Stu got out of his chair, leaned over Tommy Wanamaker and Hank Carmichael, and flicked off all 8 switches at once, 4 with each hand. So he was the only one who didn't see the Chev as it hit the gas pumps on the upper island and sheared them off. It plowed into them with a slowness that seemed implacable and somehow grand. Tommy Wanamaker swore in the Indian head the next day that the taillights never flashed once. The Chevy just kept coming at a steady 15 or so, like the pace car in the Tournament of Roses parade. The undercarriage screeched over the concrete island, and when the wheels hit it, everyone but Stu saw the driver's head swing limply forward and strike the windshield, starring the glass. The Chevy jumped like an old dog that had been kicked and plowed away the high test pump. It snapped off and rolled away, spilling a few dribbles of gas. The nozzle came unhooked and lay gleaming under the fluorescence. They all saw the sparks produced by the Chevy's exhaust pipe grating across the cement, and Hap, who had seen a gas station explosion in Mexico, instinctively shielded his eyes against the fireball he expected. Instead, the Chevy's rear end flirted around and fell off the pump island on the station side. The front end smashed into the low lead pump, knocking it off with a hollow bang. Almost deliberately, the Chevrolet finished its 360-degree turn, hitting the island again, broadside this time. The rear end popped up on the island and knocked the regular gas pump asprawl. And there the Chevy came to rest, trailing its rusty exhaust pipe behind it. It had destroyed all 3 of the gas pumps on that island nearest the highway. The motor continued to run choppily for a few seconds and then quit. The silence was so loud it was alarming. Holy moly, Tommy Wanamaker said breathlessly. Will she blow, Hap? If it was gonna, it already woulda, Hap said, getting up. His shoulder bumped the map case, scattering Texas, New Mexico, and Arizona every which way. Hap felt a cautious sort of jubilation. His pumps were insured, and the insurance was paid up. Mary had harped on the insurance ahead of everything. Guy must be pretty drunk, Norm said. I seen his taillights, Tommy said, his voice high with excitement. They never flashed once. Holy moly! If he'd been doing 60, we'd all be dead now. They hurried out of the office, Hap first and Stu bringing up the rear. Hap, Tommy, and Norm reached the car together. They could smell gas and hear the slow, clock-like tick of the Chevy's cooling engine. Hap opened the driver's side door, and the man behind the wheel spilled out like an old laundry sack. God damn! Norm Brouette shouted, almost screamed. He turned away, clutched his ample belly, and was sick. It wasn't the man who had fallen out. Hap had caught him neatly before he could thump to the pavement. But the smell that was issuing from the car, a sick stench compounded of blood, fecal matter, vomit, and human decay. It was a ghastly, rich, sick, dead smell. A moment later, Hap turned away, dragging the driver by the armpits. Tommy hastily grabbed the dragging feet, and he and Hap carried him into the office. In the glow of the overhead fluorescence, their faces were cheesy-looking and revolted. Hap had forgotten about his insurance money. The others looked into the car, and then Hank turned away, one hand over his mouth, little finger sticking off like a man who's just raised his wine glass to make a toast. He trotted to the north end of the station's lot and let his supper come up. Vic and Stu looked into the car for some time, looked at each other, and then looked back in. On the passenger side was a young woman, her shift dress hiked up high on her thighs. Leaning against her was a boy or girl, about 3 years old. They were both dead. Their necks had swelled up like inner tubes, and the flesh there was a purple-black color, like a bruise. The flesh was puffed up under their eyes, too. They looked, Vic later said, like those baseball players who put lampblack under their eyes to cut the glare. Their eyes bulged sightlessly. The woman was holding the child's hand. Thick mucus had run from their noses and was now clotted there. Flies buzzed around them, lighting in the mucus, crawling in and out of their open mouths. Stu had been in the war, but he had never seen anything so terribly pitiful as this. His eyes were constantly drawn back to those linked hands. He and Vic backed away and looked blankly at each other. Then they turned to the station. They could see Hap jawing frantically into the payphone. Norm was walking toward the station behind them, throwing glances at the wreck over his shoulder. The Chev's driver's side door stood sadly open. There was a pair of baby shoes dangling from the rearview mirror. Hank was standing by the door, rubbing his mouth with a dirty handkerchief. "Jesus, Stu," he said unhappily, and Stu nodded. Hap hung up the phone. The Chev's driver was lying on the floor. "Ambulance will be here in 10 minutes. Do you figure they're..." He jerked his thumb at the Chevy. "They're dead okay," Vic nodded. His lined face was yellow pale, and he was sprinkling tobacco all over the floor as he tried to make one of his shitty-smelling cigarettes. "They're the two deadest people I've ever seen." He looked at Stu, and Stu nodded, putting his hands in his pockets. He had the butterflies. The man on the floor moaned thickly in his throat, and they all looked down at him. After a moment, when it became obvious that the man was speaking, or trying very hard to speak, Hap knelt beside him. It was, after all, his station. Whatever had been wrong with the woman and child in the car was also wrong with the man. His nose was running freely, and his respiration had a peculiar undersea sound, a churning from somewhere in his chest. The flesh beneath his eyes was puffing, not black yet, but a bruised purple. His neck looked too thick, and the flesh had pushed up in a column to give him two extra chins. He was running a high fever. Being close to him was like squatting on the edge of an open barbecue pit where good coals have been laid.
"The dog," he muttered. "Did you put him out?"
"Mister," Hap said, shaking him gently, "I called the ambulance. You're going to be all right."
"Somebody's got the books,"
the man on the floor grunted, and then began to cough, racking, chain-like explosions that sent heavy mucus spraying from his mouth in long and ropey splatters. Hap leaned backward, grimacing desperately.
"Better roll him over," Vic said. "He's going to choke on it."
But before they could, the coughing tapered off into bellowsed, uneven breathing again. His eyes blinked slowly, and he looked at the men gathered above him.
"Where's this?"
"Arnett," Hap said. "Bill Hapscom's Texaco. You crashed out some of my pumps."
And then hastily he added, "That's okay, they was insured." The man on the floor tried to sit up and was unable. He had to settle for putting a hand on Hap's arm.
"My wife, my little girl."
"They're fine," Hap said, grinning a foolish dog grin.
"Seems like I'm awful sick," the man said.
Breath came in and out of him in a thick, soft roar.
"They were sick, too, since we got up 2 days ago. Tahoe."
His eyes flickered slowly closed.
"Sick. Guess we didn't move quick enough after all."
Far off, but getting closer, they could hear the whoop of the Arnett volunteer ambulance.
Man, Tommy Wanamaker said. Oh, man.
The sick man's eyes fluttered open again, and now they were filled with an intense, sharp concern. He struggled again to sit up. Sweat ran down his face. He grabbed Hap.
Are Sally and Levon all right?
He demanded. Spittle flew from his lips, and Hap could feel the man's burning heat radiating outward. The man was sick, half crazy. He stank. Hap was reminded of the smell an old dog blanket gets sometimes.
They're all right, he insisted a little frantically. You just lay down and take it easy, okay?
The man lay back down. His breathing was rougher now. Hap and Hank helped roll him over on his side, and his respiration seemed to ease a trifle.
I felt okay until last night, he said. Woke up with it in the night. Didn't get away quick enough. Is baby Levon okay?
This last trailed off into something none of them could make out. The ambulance siren warbled closer and closer. Stu went over to the window to watch for it. The others remained in a circle around the man on the floor.
What's he got, Vic? Any idea?
Hap asked. Vic shook his head.
Don't know. Might have been something they ate, Norm Bruett said. That car's got a California plate. They was probably eating a lot of roadside stands, you know. Maybe they got a poison hamburger. It happens.
The ambulance pulled in and skirted the wrecked Chevy to stop between it and the station door. The red light on top made crazy sweeping circles. It was full dark now.
Give me your hand and I'll pull you up out of there,
the man on the floor cried suddenly, and then was silent.
Food poisoning, Vic said.
Yeah, that could be.
I hope so, because...
Because what? Hank asked.
Because otherwise it might be something catching.
Vic looked at them with troubled eyes.
I seen cholera back in 1948 down in Nogales, and it looked something like this.
Three men came in wheeling a stretcher.
Hap, one of them said. You're lucky you didn't get your scourgy old ass blown to Kingdom Come. This guy, huh?
They broke apart to let them through. Billy Verrecker, Monty Sullivan, Carlos Ortega, men they all knew.
There's two folks in that car, Hap said, drawing Monty aside. Woman and little girl, both dead. Holy crow, you sure? Yeah, this guy, he don't know. You gonna take him to Braintree?
I guess, Monty looked at him, bewildered.
What do I do with the two in the car? I don't know how to handle this, Hap. Stu can call the state patrol. You mind if I ride in with you?
Hell no.
They got the sick man onto the stretcher, and while they ran him out, Hap went over to Stu.
I'm going to ride into Braintree with that guy. Would you call the state patrol?
Sure.
And Mary, too, call and tell her what happened.
Okay.
Hap trotted out to the ambulance and climbed in. Billy Verrecker shut the doors behind him and then called the other two. They had been staring into the wrecked Chevy with dread fascination. A few moments later, the ambulance pulled out, siren warbling, red dome light pulsing blood shadows across the station's tarmac. Stu went to the phone and put a dime in. The man from the Chevy died 20 miles from the hospital. He drew one final bubbling gasp, let it out, hitched in a smaller one, and just quit. Hap got the man's wallet out of his hip pocket and looked at it. There was $17 in cash. A California driver's license identified him as Charles D. Campion. There was an army card and pictures of his wife and daughter encased in plastic. Hap didn't want to look at the pictures. He stuffed the wallet back into the dead man's pocket and told Carlos to turn off the siren. It was 9:10.